My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
My home group is the McKean Street Miracle Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at St. Agnes Hospital, Broad and McKean Street, South Philadelphia, 7 nights a week at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in town, please, we'd like to have you. I'm not there 7 nights a week, you know, personalities. I'm there at least twice a week. I go to other groups. But we'd like to have you anyway. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come down, you know. Yeah, there was a slight delay yesterday, but Ed should have caught my act like in Charlotte, where I missed my plane. But chapter 5 tells me what I'm supposed to do. I will tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar, very ethnic neighborhood. You know, there was no booze in all my house. My father did not drink. My mother could not drink. I got 8 brothers and sisters. We lived in a small 3-bedroom row home, and we were one of the smaller families on the block, you know. But my grandparents lived around the corner from us, and they had a bar in their basement, and that's where I had my first drink. And that's where all the family functions were held, you know, the parties, the christenings, graduations, and things like that. I forget how old I was. I was young, but I remember my first drink. I remember it was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father and the old scoreboard. And right center field was Ballantine, the 3 rings. And I remember I was in my grandparents' basement bar, and I was going around and polishing off the half empties or the half fulls, whatever. And my uncles, the attention I got from my uncles, hey, look at that, look at Bobby. And I loved that. Because I never felt a part of, which is pretty tough when you got, you know, like 11 people in a small house. But I never felt a part of, and that would be true, you know, into recovery for me, you know. But I loved the attention that came with it. My drinking really took off in high school. Most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school, but my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And I felt out of place there because most of the kids who went there were from affluent families from the suburbs. It was just me and a couple of the dirtballs from my neighborhood who had gone there. And we used to walk to school, you know, which gave us a reputation because, like, it was a kind of rough area, you know. And these kids, they were getting dropped off by their parents in the luxury automobiles. And me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong. But, you know, I did things. I knew my gut was wrong, but I did it anyway because we thought we had a reputation that we had to live up to, you know, and I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coyle, you know. I'm at the prep, I guess about 2 weeks, it's football season, you know, it's fall, and there was a football game, there was an away game, we rented a bus, and there was, we got some, you know, beer and liquor, and, you know, there was some fighting, and there was some police, and it was just really nuts. And then, you know, when the disciplinarian came over, he said, you know, I'll see all you guys Monday morning. Well, we're lined up outside his office Monday morning. There's about 8 or 9 of us. It was just me and another kid from the neighborhood, 2 freshmen. Everyone else were upperclassmen. He came directly up to us, you know, both of us. He said, what's the matter with you guys? You guys here like a week and a half, you're in this jackpot already? And I just shrugged my shoulders. Yeah, you know, Father, it's just one of them things. And what it was, it didn't take me long to size up the situation, you know. I knew what guys were drinking and were about, you know, acting out, and that's who I went to hang out with. I didn't want to hang out with the good kids or the smart kids or any of that other stuff. By my sophomore year, I was this school, like I said, is a pretty rough area. It's in North Philadelphia, and a couple blocks away, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And by the time that I was a sophomore, I was a regular at the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And I went there for a couple different reasons. You know, they had dancers there, they had cold beer. But a lot of times I just wanted to show, you know, again, this reputation I thought that I had, you know, that we had to show these other kids from the suburbs how tough we were. Because the school was on 18th Street, 4 blocks away is the subway. These kids used to take the trolley car 4 blocks to catch the subway because they were scared to walk through the neighborhood. So, but I would stroll out Gerard Avenue and sit at the Ebony to show how tough I was. I can now tell you that I've never been a tough guy, and every day I sat in the Ebony, I was terrified. But I didn't want anybody else to know because, again, playing these roles, you know, this head, you know, it's nuts. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education, and it kind of ticked my parents off because, you know, they really struggled to send me there, you know, made a lot of sacrifices. So I know I couldn't stay home because there'd be hell to catch, and I had very few options, you know. 17 years old, you know, high school diploma, I couldn't get a job, didn't have any money, so I enlisted in the service. And That really wasn't a bright move because back then nobody else was going, you know. But I enlisted and, you know, I got sent overseas and I spent 13 months overseas and that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I knew a lot of guys from my neighborhood had gone over and got whacked on certain things. And I guess I had a fear. I didn't mess around with any stuff at all. But I was definitely drunk. And, you know, I was there a couple months and several good friends of mine got killed. And I didn't know how to handle that, you know. We grew up, we didn't tell anybody nothing. You know, it was all surface stuff. And once you moved out of the house, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the house. You know, everything stayed in the house and everything stayed inside. So once you moved out, whether you got married or went to school, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. So I didn't know how to handle this, but booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did, you know. I didn't distinguish myself, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by, and I was satisfied with that. When my tour was up, I came back home. I enrolled in school at St. Joe's College, and I was there for a little bit, you know, and it was springtime, and one day, one of the guys from my neighborhood had called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, we're going to go to the Phillies game this afternoon. Would you be interested? It's one of them businessman specials, you know, one of them weekday, like 12:30 afternoon games. I said, sure. So I cut class, me and four other guys from the neighborhood. The Phillies had since moved. They're playing at the Vet Stadium. We're up in the 700 level, the top of the stadium, hot day, drinking that cheap watered-down beer, and the sun's beating down on me, and I'm getting trashed, you know? Not that it took much, but I'm getting trashed, and I told one of the guys I was with, I said, you know what, I said, I'm going to run down in the field and meet one of the players. And they say, that's okay, and they kind of shrugged me off, because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell these stories, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I did that. I didn't do nothing, I drank, that's what I did. So they kind of shrugged it off. So I worked my way down to the old picnic area, and then I had jumped over the fence, and I ran out in right field. And the San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was playing right field for the Padres. It's the mid-70s, and I go up, I shake his hand, I said, hi, Dave, how you doing? He looked at me, he said, brother, he said, what are you doing out here? And from behind him, I saw the guards coming. I said, Dave, I got to go now. So I started running towards the infield, and I went to slide into second base. But I figured if I slid into the base, I'd get caught because there was guards coming from the third base side. So as I got closer to the infield, I turned around and started walking towards first base. And I'm as close to the guard as we are right now, about 10 feet. I'm walking to give myself up to the guard. And at the last second, I deked the guy, and I ran out in the outfield. Now I'm running around like a lunatic. It seems like about 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to like 3 or 4. And up on the scoreboard, they put Mr. Excitement. It was incredible. I'm running around, and I finally give up because I'm drunk, I'm hot, I'm out of breath. I thought I was going to throw up. You know? So I finally give up. I'm standing in right field, and the guards got me, and they was taking me off the field. I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from the guards, but that was okay. This standing ovation, you could have beat me all day out of your hair. So as they was taking me off the field, Tug McGraw was in the bullpen, and he gave me the thumbs up. Hey, way to go. You know, I knew I was going to get it beaten, and just then a Philadelphia police lieutenant came up to me. He said, what's the matter with you? He said, are you drunk? Are you high? I said, no, so I'm just happy. I'm happy to be here. He said, well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium. So not only did he save me from a beating, but he saved me from getting arrested, which was important because, like, when I came home, I took, like, several civil service exams, and about a month after that incident, you know, I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. But, you know, I tell that story for a couple different reasons. It's true. But, you know, it's the only funny story I got. I don't remember. I was a major blackout drinker. I blacked out from my earliest drinking. And there's a lot of things I don't remember. I remember, like, I would show up at the bar the next day, and my friends, they would say, oh, man, you was nuts last night. And they would tell me different things. I didn't remember anything. I was a major blackout drinker. Another thing about that story, you know, for your sports fans out there, earlier this week, Dave Winfield has been inducted to the Hall of Fame. Now, I was thinking, you know, maybe I can go up to Cooperstown during the summer and, who knows, maybe I could run up on stage and shake his hand and say, hey, Dave, remember me? But we don't do that sober. But I was a major blackout drinker, you know. So I get hired by the city, and Back then, it's the 70s, and we have a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo, who was a former cop himself. He was a former police commissioner. There was 8,500 of us. We had to run to the city. We did whatever we wanted to do. I'm not even old enough to drink. The drinking age is 21. Before I got hired, Jersey's right across the river. In fact, where I lived in Philly, I could be in Jersey quicker than I could be other sections of Philadelphia. And the drinking age in Jersey was 18, so I used to go across the bridge and drink. But once I came on the job, I could go anywhere I wanted. And I wasn't even old enough to drink. And I was hanging out with these guys. Most of the guys I hung out with older guys. And that was always my deal, too. Even when I was younger, I always hung out with guys a couple years older than me. Didn't want to miss out on any action. And that's, evident, that story I told my freshman year in high school, hanging out with these upperclassmen drinking. So all these guys, they were all Vietnam vets, and they were all nuts, and, drinking and just having a blast. So there were a lot of things I saw in the job that bothered me, though, I was in a pretty rough part of town, and I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out, and the consequences that came with that. And some things bothered me, but at the end of the day, at the end of the tour, we go to the bar with guys in my squad and be drinking, telling stories and lies and things like that. And I didn't want to tell people the way I felt for real, because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be part of the boys. And to the point where I started even engaging in behaviors that I was uncomfortable with, but I thought it came to be expected of my coworkers. So, and I was off to the races, my drinking was ugly, and it was ugly quickly, and the signs were on the wall, and I was the last guy to figure it out. I had an uncle in the job, and he was a supervisor, and I was at a family function one day, and he pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, Bobby? I'm hearing stories about you. You better, ease up, or you're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You got to be careful." One ear and out the other. I had a supervisor, my immediate supervisor on the job. One day I come to work, he pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid?" He said, "You're smart and you're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up." One ear and out the other. When I later got sober, I was in a meeting on two separate occasions. I ran into my uncle and I ran into the supervisor. And I realized at that point, back then, they were trying to 12-step me. But I remember talking to my uncle. I said, "Jimmy," I said, "how come you didn't tell me?" He said, "I told you." He said, "You just weren't listening." One ear and out the other. So everyone knew but me, And it was just got uglier. I was 24 years old, and I wound up shooting and killed a 15-year-old kid in the line of work. And it was really a terrible situation. I couldn't be avoided. And I used that as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. And there was a lot of help offered to me, but I just, it turned everyone away, wallowed in self-pity. And it was just nuts. My drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers is the use of other substances. I'd say, I would never do this. Well, I wound up getting promoted and transferred into a unit, and one day I was in a situation where I thought that I had to do something, and obviously since I was drinking, my judgment was impaired, and I started getting involved in other substances. My drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months, but it really drove me to my knees and helped me to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think due to the fifth tradition, that's really all I only need to touch on that subject, I was a pig. I was an ugly human being. I was nasty. If I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with, And I tried to stop drinking a lot of different times, I would have my supervisors threaten me because I was abusing my sick time. I was probably involved with a girl at the time, and she told me that I was a nut, that I would need to stop drinking, or she would leave. I would try to stop for Lent. I would try to stop for all these other reasons. And I stopped several different times, but I could never stay stopped, I would go to the bar and think I would only get a couple, and I would always close the bar, When I worked the swing shift, I would go in, I'd get in the bar about 11:30, and I thought I would have to double up to make up for all the guys who had been there since 7 o'clock that night, Or that I thought I could hang out all night, go to speakeasies and things like that, because I wasn't due to work the next day at 3 o'clock, I worked midnight date. When I got done in the morning, I'd be in the bar and people would look at me, and I would rationalize it. Well, I said, "This is my nighttime." I was always curious how guys could be in the bar 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning drinking, And I would go to this bar. It was called the Dust Bowl. It was right around the corner from the Ironworkers Union Hall. And for all the ironworkers who got, rained out that day, they would be there. And I couldn't ask, "Well, Christ, this is your morning. You got rained out. You're here drinking. You only been up 2 hours. Here, I'm up 9 hours. Just got done working. So that's why I'm here drinking." It was like I could justify anything, But my drinking really got ugly. Those last 3 years, from 24 to 27, it was pathetic, and especially my year and a half involved in other substances. I was home from work one day, and I saw an ad in the paper. It said, alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, thoughts of suicide, marital problems. I was 4 out of 5. I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd have been batting 1,000. And I'm looking at the ad, you know, and they talk about the moment of sanity or clarity, and I take a look at it, and as soon as it came, it left quickly. And I said, no, but something made me cut that ad out. I stuck it in my wallet, you know. I continued on drinking. I was at Memorial Day weekend, and I'm at this bar, you know, guys in my squad were having a party. And towards the end of the party, one of the guys I was with, he says, you know what? He said, I'm going to drive home. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, how about if I give you a ride home? You know, this is before designated driver, you know. And I don't think I'm drunk as you, and I'll give you a ride home. He says, all right. He thought that was a good idea. So together in my car, we're riding out the street, and about a block and a half away, I see a kid on a bicycle. And I decided I was going to show off my driving skills to my coworker. I was always a show-off. Really, I was arrogant. And I was going to show off my driving skills to my coworker. And as I raced, sped up towards this kid on the bike, unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran this kid over. As he lied bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car. My nightstick was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that, so I pulled this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, I made a remark, I scored 10 points, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep, you know. I don't know what to do. So I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances, and I checked in a hotel with the intention to consume all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And at this point, I was suspended from my job, and, you know, so they come knocking on the door. They kick me out of the hotel 3 days later, and, you know, I told them I'd be with them in a minute. And I was suspended from my job, so I no longer had access to my weapons, so I couldn't shoot myself. So I walked over to the window, and I opened up the window. I was going to jump out. And I was on the 5th floor, and I remembered when I opened up the window, I was scared of heights, and I couldn't jump. So I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub up with water, and I had a blow dryer, and I was going to pull the blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about 1.5 feet short on cord. So I'm standing 1 foot in the tub, leaning, trying to plug it in. And it seems it's like a scene out of a Woody Allen movie. I couldn't even kill myself, you know. So the only other tool I had left was my car. So I took one last spin through my neighborhood, and I started up in Philadelphia at the Falls Bridge. And I came down East River Drive, and that's a winding road along the Schuylkill River. And I decided I was going to end my life in an automobile accident. And as I was coming down the drive, I was flying, and I just started crying. I just lost it. And I really didn't want to go to oncoming traffic because I didn't want to hurt anybody else. At this point, you know, I'm just at the point, you know, I've hurt everyone, you know, and I didn't want to live. I don't know if I want to die, but I was just so wrecked. And I was also whacked, you know, alcohol and drugs in my system for the last 3 days. And I'm just a basket case. And as I was coming down the drive, I'm crying. And I now know my higher power was looking out after me, but I didn't know that then. And I finally pull over. At the end of the East River Drive is Boathouse Row. And I pull over outside Boathouse Row, and I just started crying like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my wallet, and there was that ad that I clicked out of the Daily News 6 weeks before. And it's no longer there, but at the end of the last boathouse, one of those glass-enclosed phone booths, I went in the phone, I pulled out my wallet, and I had that ad, and I called that phone number up to the ad, on the ad, you know. And a woman answered the phone, and I started telling her my story. And once I started, I couldn't stop, you know. And God bless her, patiently she just listened. And she must have had a coworker working behind the scenes, because when I finally got done, she said, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital and somebody be waiting there to talk to you. I says, okay. So I drove over to Hahnemann Hospital, and they was waiting for me. And they admitted me to the 11th floor of their psychiatric unit. And I was there about 3 days. And from there, I get transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to another VA hospital out in Coatesville. And spent about 3 or 4 weeks in their flight deck before they put me in an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over and called that phone number, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. See, I didn't think I had a problem with booze. I thought I had a mental illness, and I inherited that from my mother. Maybe it's my short use of other substances. Maybe it's this stress stuff they're talking about, and I got that from the service, or I got that from my job. You know, maybe it's the neighborhood I grew up in. You know, maybe the fact I'm a mummer, and I'll talk about that later. I don't want confusion now. But there's all this other stuff going on. And as it couldn't be alcohol, I was a beer drinker. I never drank hard liquor. I was a beer drinker. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Paddy's Day or like New Year's Day or like payday. But I was a beer drinker. I was a beer drinker. And you couldn't be an alcoholic drinking beer, you know? You know, to back up a little bit, you know, get nervous up here. Before I checked in that day, one day I showed off for work, and one of my coworkers was drunk. And my supervisor said, you know, take this guy up to our unit. We had an EAP unit, and so I took him up to this unit. This is 1979. So I drive up, I'm coming down the driveway, and part of this EAP unit, they also had an AA group there, the 369 group. It was like a special interest group. It was like for cops, sworn personnel, and things like that. So I pulled up to the porch, and there's this guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie M. And I said, Eddie, I just dropped this guy off. I said, I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up. It's 1979. He said, kid, would you like to come in? Would you like to come into the meeting too? And I was insulted that he asked me. I said, no, I don't want to come in here. I knew what AA was. AA was for you older guys, you'd marry guys, you guys with three heads. Again, like I was a beer drinker, I didn't have a problem. You know, when I finally got out of VA hospital, I was in making outside meetings for about 2 weeks before I finally ran into Eddie. And I walked into a meeting, and all he did, he just stood there, he just smiled. He said, it's okay, you finally came around. And it was just goes to show you, everybody knew but me. I was the last guy to figure it out. At the VA hospital, when they put me in the alcohol and drug ward, I'm sitting in the day room, and they had, you know, the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. I go up to them, I'm checking them steps out. I got about six of them done. I saw the amends. I said, they're screwed, that doesn't apply to me, you know. But what happened later tonight, two men came up and carried the message, and I would later find out that they were on a commitment from the treatment facility committee from the intergroup. But I didn't know that then. They came up and they told their story. And you know what? The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't relate to, I couldn't identify with, or I just didn't like, I would immediately tune him out. See, I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. And besides, a lot of these guys I was in the VA hospital with, they all got locked up. And I definitely wasn't as bad as them, you know? So again, this arrogance. But what bothered me the most was at the end of this AA meeting, everyone held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people were about, then I didn't want nothing to do with you. You know, I talk about my mom. My mom had a mental illness, and, you know, among many things, she was a fundamentalist, you know. And there were, you know, radio shows and candles and, you know, pictures and rosaries and everything else throughout the house. I was 15 years old. I was in high school. I came home one day, and I'm in my house about 10 minutes. And then I finally came across my mother. She had slit her wrist. And I remember when I found her, she looked up at me, she said, Bobby, help me. And I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. And I got an older guy to get me a quart of wine. And I remember I stayed out, you know, drank the wine. And I came home later that night. And by that time, I thought I came home and found her. And it was too late. And I remember my dad told me, he told me what happened. I said, oh, how about that? You know, that happened when I was 15. I didn't get sober till I was 27. So that's 12 years I have a resentment towards God. I didn't want nothing to do. I broke away from the circle, wouldn't participate in a prayer. And I would have this resentment for a couple more years, you know. I was nasty. I was very standoffish, you know. And you know what? It was all facade. And there was a nurse up there for some reason took a liking to me. And she came up the day before I got out. She came up to me. She said, you know what? She said, I don't know what your deal is. She said, but if you really want to get a chance, you're going to need to go to AA meetings. And I need to tell you that's probably the best piece of advice I got when I was there. The VA hospital helped me out tremendously with a lot of different things. But you know what? I would get my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came to AA meetings every single day. And I got there late and I would leave early. I don't drink coffee, so I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes, so I don't empty no ashtrays. You know? If I walked into a big book meeting or a step meeting that was strictly by accident, I would leave at the break because I had something more important to do. I was interested in war stories, and the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, couldn't relate to, or just didn't identify with it, I immediately tuned him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. And at the end of the meeting, when he would say the Lord's Prayer, hold hands, I would break away from the circle. And then the old guys in the back of the room would say, keep coming back. And I thought they were facetious. I said, I'll keep coming back, you old SOB. I was crazy as a bed bug. I was nuts. I was sober about 8 or 9 months, and I'm sitting in this bar because they sell real good roast beef. I'm drinking seltzer in a glass, you know. And, you know, I'm in there, and guys in the neighborhood came in, and they start, you know, giving me a hard time, you know, breaking my stones, making marks and things like that. And I finally couldn't take it anymore, and I stood up, and I had this rock glass, and I just punched this guy right in the face with the glass and cut him severely, opened up the side of his face. The cops came, but the guys who handled the job, they knew me, and they cut me a break, and they let me go. And that's where I learned my lessons about people, places, and things. And I have since found a place that sells roast beef without being in that type of environment, you know. But the real deal, why I was really there, again, I was arrogant, you know what. And there was a part of my career that, you know, things were going well, and I was getting a lot of attention, a lot of publicity. And towards the end of, you know, my drinking, I got a lot of negative publicity. And so some, you know, guys in my neighborhood just, you know, I could understand where they were coming from. They just wanted to knock me down a couple pegs. But now I'm back. You know, things are going good. That's why I was in that bar 9 months sober, for no other reason. I needed to show people that I was back, that I was okay. Man, I was just nuts. I was sober a year. I celebrated my story. And, you know, when I got done speaking, it was amazing. You know, thunderous applause. The lame could walk. The blind could see. Yeah. People came up and they were patting me in the back and saying, man, way to go, kid. You're doing so good. I lied during my entire story. I made stuff up. The biggest lie is when I identified myself as an alcoholic. I did not believe that I was an alcoholic still. I still thought it was my short use of all the substances. I still thought I was mentally ill, and I got that from my mom, and I had this stress stuff. You know, I was a beer drinker. In fact, during the course of telling my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys didn't want to hear that. You wanted to hear all the clever quotes. So I gave you what you wanted to hear, you know, quoted the literature and... Man, when they came up and they were patting me on the back and saying, you're doing so good, man, I was dying inside. I felt like a creep. But you know what? I hated these people, but you know what? I wanted to be part of this crowd, but I couldn't humble myself to ask for help. It was really a tough, crazy space. And the only time I would get my hand up to share, you know, because I was really quiet, the only time I would get my hand up to share was like to take a shot at somebody. You know, if they said something earlier, and I would need to come back and take a shot at them. I was crazy. I would go to the men's room or I'd go get a cup of tea or something to come back. The seat next to me would be vacant. They had moved. They would be sitting on the other side of the room. Then I'd be trying to glare, like stare them down. I was so nuts. In my early recovery, first couple years, I used to go to a lot of go-go bars, but I drank seltzer. And I would go to the bars, right, and then I would get my pictures taken, right? Then I would come to the meetings and pass these pictures around to the old-timers because I really liked these guys, and I thought if they would see this picture with me, like with these dancers, that they would like me and they would talk to me. And these guys would take a look at the picture, and they would look at me, and they would just shake their heads, man, please keep coming back. I was nuts. One day, the men in the group were going on a retreat, and somebody signed me up. And even though I had the resources to go, I didn't want to go. Somebody signed me up. And... Man, I was paranoid. And I wanted to be part of these guys. I really did. I liked these guys. But, you know, I always talked about them. You know, and so I went. And as we were driving up to the retreat, I had a knot in my stomach because I never told anybody about my mom, you know. And I just couldn't do it. I had this resentment towards God. And I think that's why they signed me up, because they got tired of seeing me outside the circle and holding hands. So I'm at the retreat. We pull up. I'm there about 15 minutes when I run into the retreat master. As soon as he saw me, his eyes lit up. He's my disciplinarian from high school. And he was also a longtime member of our fellowship. And he just smiled when he saw me. He said, so, he said, that was your problem. He said, good to see you. And we start talking. He said, listen, he said, you got yourself a sponsor? You know, I told him how long I'm sober. I'm sober almost 2 years. I says, no, I said, I don't have a sponsor. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. I said, okay. So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor. And the only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. And he would tell me, he said, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. In fact, you know what I used to do? I used to make stories up about this. I said, oh, you can't believe this guy. He's making me do this. He's telling me this. He didn't do nothing. I made it all up, you know. But it was nuts. So, little after that, week after that, I beat another man with a baseball bat, 23 months sober. I forget what step I was working that day, but it was nuts. And I hurt him pretty bad, you know, and it was great, nuts. I was making meetings every single day in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was dying from untreated alcoholism. I was a liar, thief, and a cheat. I did everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I did right, I didn't pick up a drink. And I would go to meetings, and I would share these witty stories, and people patted me on the back, and they say, that's okay, just don't drink. You know what? And I now know that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, that's a lie. When people say, just don't drink no matter what and go to a meeting. Well, I drank no matter what. You know, I drank when I had a job and when I was suspended, I drank. I drank when I had a girlfriend and when she left me, I drank. I drank when I was, you know, had a pocket full of money, and when I didn't, I drank because I stole your money. I mean, I drank 4th of July, Labor Day, Memorial Day, September 6th, it didn't matter, 4 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Saturday, Tuesday. I drank no matter what, you know. I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I do. I drink, you know. When people say, just don't drink no matter what, that implies willpower. Well, you know what? I have no willpower whatsoever. And that's a direct contradiction to the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol. I drank knowing that there was negative consequences of coming with it. I drank knowing that my girlfriend would leave me. And you know what? I really cared for her. I just think I liked booze a little bit more. I drank when I got threatened with suspension from my job. And I loved my job. My job was my identity. And you know what? I drank anyway. You know, I drank no matter what. You know, and that's just the type of guy that I was. And man, I was nuts. And I would share these witty stories with people, and they would pat me in the back and say, just don't drink no matter what. Just don't drink and go to a meeting. And then I'm the clever guy. I said, well, if I could just not drink, why do I need to go to a meeting? How come I can't stay home and watch the Flyers and just not drink? Oh, it's nuts. Crazy. You know, my second anniversary came. I didn't celebrate it. You know, a month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before. But 25 months before, I was loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was dying from untreated alcoholism. There was a guy from my neighborhood. His nickname was Troubles. That should sum everything up. Nickname was Troubles. Troubles was in and out of jail in the 60s and the 70s like a revolving door. I've seen him. He was sober in AA for about 4 or 5 years. He had this glow about him. He was for real. It wasn't in the meetings. It was in the neighborhood, you know, where it's tough to stay sober. In the meetings, anyone can sound good. But in the neighborhood, I saw this guy. He was for real, you know. And one day after the meeting, I went up to him. I said, Bobby was his name. I didn't call him Troubles. I said, Bobby, because I was scared of him. And I said, Bobby, I need some help. I said, I need a sponsor. He said, would you be my sponsor? He looked down at me, and he smiled, and, you know, I sponsored. He likes me because, you know, he's a tough guy, right? He said, Bobby, I've been watching you for a couple years. And I stuck my chest down. I said, all right. He said, and you're full of shit. And I couldn't believe he said that. And I looked at him. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. He said, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to one big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting a week. You're going to go to a men's meeting a week. You're going to leave them damn women alone, and you're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. And I'm looking at him, and I'm saying to myself, like, who's he talking to? I'm 25 months sober here. I'm selling the grapevines. You know, don't you know who I am? You know, but what I did, I looked him dead in the eye. I said, okay, I'll do that. You know, I'm willing to do that. And that's the night that I started working the program, you know, because I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I really did know that. But I went to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable, you know. And if I was powerless, you know, the second step had to be a power greater myself. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out, you know. And that night, you know, we talked afterwards, and then he took me back to his home. And then together I got on my knees and said the third step prayer with him. You know, and then he introduced me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Bobby, I've been listening to you. He said, you're full of crap. You don't know nothing. When you go to meetings, please just shut the hell up and listen. But you know what? He wasn't saying it mean, you know. You know the old saying, say what you mean what you say, just don't say it mean. And that's what he was doing. That's the type of language that I needed. Because all these other guys, you know, at this period of time, my neighborhood's going through some sort of gentrification. So a lot of yuppies are coming in, right? But these guys can't identify with me, you know, blue-collar guy, cop, and all this other stuff. So I need to hang out with, like, the rough guys. But he saw all through that stuff, you know, and he called me on it all the time. And he helped me tremendously. He introduced me to the big book. He said, this is the program. You don't know nothing about it, and this is what we're going to do. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I didn't want to do one of these four steps. I would go to meetings. I hear people saying, whoa, easy does it. Don't want to get well too soon. I mean, if that ain't the craziest line, I swear to God. It's like getting a little cough, you know. Whoa, don't want to get well too soon. You're right. Let me get some bronchitis and maybe I'll feel better. And then you got bronchitis and people say, whoa, don't want to get well too soon. Keep it simple. And you wind up with pneumonia. Easy does it. And before you know it, you're dead. I mean, I'll get into more. I mean, I'm a cancer survivor. I mean, you know, the key to other illnesses is to get treatment as soon as possible. Don't want to get well too soon. Well, you know what? I easy does it for almost 25 months and was going to kill myself or somebody else, you know. I didn't know nothing about recovery. You know, I did my inventory. And you know what? It wasn't that big. I mean, things were stirred up when I wrote it down, but everything I wrote down, I did. There were, like, no surprises jumped out. You know? So it came time to do my fifth step, right? And, you know, I kind of drug my feet a little bit, and I finally called my sponsor, and I said, whoa, easy way out. I said, Bobby, I said, I want to go on a retreat. He said, do my fifth step, with it, you know. And he said, that's great. He said, when you get done, he said, come by my house and you can do it with me. And you know how sponsors can be, you know. And I'm on my phone, like, saying to myself, like, what are you, deaf? You didn't hear what I said? I said, I'm going to do it with this priest. And I said, Bobby, I told you I'm going on this retreat. He said, oh, Bobby, I heard you. He said, well, when you get done, you're going to stop by my house. He said, because my job is to help you walk through these steps and, you know, help you with your recovery and help you with your character defects. I think I need to know what they are. And I need to tell you the reason I was going to go to this priest and not to Bobby. Because, you know, we've thrown the same neighborhood. He's a few years older than me. But there were a lot of things about my behavior that I was embarrassed about. And I was afraid that if I would tell him these things, that he would ridicule me, pass judgment, or even worse, tell other people. And if I had those fears, that tells me my, you know, my fourth step wasn't complete. I had to go back and add some more fears. And I thought if I did it with this priest that he was bound, you know, he wasn't going to tell anybody. Confidentiality. You know, got all bases covered here, you know. I never went to the priest. I did my fifth step with Bobby. And you know what? All those fears that I had, they were unfounded. He didn't do anything. He didn't laugh at me, didn't pass judgment, and he didn't tell anybody else. In fact, you know what he did? He shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness that I thought that I was the only guy to have certain thoughts or did certain things. And I'll be forever in his debt for doing that, you know. I remember a couple months later, you know, I was talking to him. And the sponsors, you know, had to get that radar on. They can tell when you're acting like a nitwit. And I'm talking to him. And he said, Bobby, out of the blue, he said, where are you adding them steps? And, you know, I smiled to myself. I said, well, you know, like we did that fifth step. He said, Bobby, that was months ago. He said, this is a 12-step program, not a fifth-step program. A five-step program. I said, all right. And, you know, the character defects. And since I did my inventory, I knew what they were, you know. I didn't know before I did my inventory. I heard people talking about character defects. And, you know, you got your own lingo, even though I had the benefit of 5 months of being in the flight deck at the VA hospital. When I went to my first outside meeting, they were talking. I was confused. Man, inventory resentments, you know, character defects. I knew I was a character when I drank, But I found out when I did my inventory that I found that I had no character whatsoever. You know, I was selfish and self-centered to the extreme. And, you know, I was willing. Sponsor said, Bobby, you need to put legs on those prayers. I mean, I can ask God all day long to help me with my character defects, help me be patient, help me be honest. But, you know, if I'm in a position and I choose to be impatient or dishonest, that prayer goes out the window. He said, it's a program of action, you know. And because I didn't burn my fourth step when I did my fifth step with him when it came to time to step eight, most of my list was completed. And I just had to put more names down. And I was one of these guys that said, you know what, I didn't harm anybody but myself when I drank. That should have been the tip-off that I never did my inventory. But I found out that everyone I came in contact with I harmed, you know, and I had to put everyone's name, and it became willing. The ninth step direct amends. No phone calls, no letters from me, because I didn't beat you with a bat over the phone or through the mail, you know. I mean, and when I want to take those measures, I can justify it, you know, but the fact is I would probably be scared to face you face-to-face. That's why I want to send them letters, you know. My sponsor said, Bobby, direct amends, face people, you know. And, you know, God is putting people in my path, you know. Because it says, whenever possible, you know. Wherever possible. I always thought that said, whenever possible. When denotes time. And, you know, for us, it's never the right time. Because we're too busy keeping it simple. Easy does it. It's amazing how we can hide behind them slogans, you know. I tell you, you know, I remember when the first time I saw the slogans, when I was in the VA hospital, I saw them, you know, slogans up on the wall. And it finally dawned on me. You know, when I worked in uniform, I remember when I would pull cars over and I would see the bumper stickers, you know, just for today, you know. You live and let live. I would come up and say, oh, I'm going to get one of these Jesus freaks. They're going to hammer me, you know, as I'm writing them up. Now when I got, you know, in the VA hospital, I saw up the slogans. Now I realized everyone in AA was still speeding. It was amazing. I'm going to a meeting, officer. Yeah, got an important meeting to go to. It's amazing. So the ninth step, and I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step, you know. I'm at this meeting one day, almost 10 years ago. I see this guy I have not seen since 1977. This guy is not on my men's list, not for any reason. I just plain forgot, no out of sight, out of mind. But as soon as I saw this guy, I recognized him, you know. And I tell you what I used to do. His name was Bob also, you know. I was in a bar one day, and I was involved in a situation with him, and he didn't respond. So from that point on, whenever I want to impress people, to show how tough I was, I would publicly humiliate this guy because I knew that he wasn't going to do anything. And I would verbally abuse him and slap him, and one day I even spit on him. I mean, what worse thing can you do to a human being but spit on him? And so I haven't seen this guy, and you know what, I'm at the table, I'm going to speak, and he didn't recognize me. You know, we clean up after we get sober.
And I stood up and I looked him dead in the eyes. My name is Bobby Coyle and I'm an alcoholic. And then he smiled and then he remembered me. And I need to tell you why I use my full name. I believe I understand the 11th and the 12th traditions, you know. This is not a secret society, you know. All of a sudden, we get sober and we become like the mafia. We get all these nicknames, you know. You got Red Sweater Jerry and Bucktooth Mary and Frank the Fox and Pepsi George. You know, get all these nicknames. You know, we don't want anyone to know. Everyone in my neighborhood knew I was a drunk. It was those little telltale signs, you know. They came outside, they would catch me, I was urinating on their car. Yeah. My clothes would be thrown out the window, you know. I'd be slumped behind the wheel of my car. You know, I would have all type of insanity in my house. Everybody knew I was a drunk. All of a sudden, I get sober. I'm afraid my reputation is going to be tarnished if people know I go to AA. Yeah, it's crazy. The 11th tradition is real clear. I don't go on the radio. I don't go on the television. And I don't appear in the newspaper and say, my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the 11th tradition says. You know, Dr. Bob said, when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition. Anonymity is spiritually inspired. Secrecy is spirit inspired. I mean, what happens 2 o'clock in the morning? You feel like you're going to pick up a drink. You're going to call information. Yeah, I'd like to have Bucktooth Mary's phone number. Now hang up on it. Or if you go to the hospital and you want to visit one of these old timers. Yeah, I'm here to visit Frank the Fox. If they got a psych ward, they're going to admit you. You know? It's not a secret society. However, it's just my personal preference because I've been heavily involved in service in my area. That's why I use my full name. I have no right whatsoever to break anybody else's anonymity, and I need to respect that. So that's my slant on the 11th tradition. So I looked this guy dead in the eye and said, my name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. And he smiled. He recognized me. And when I got done speaking, I told the group what I used to do to him. And I figured I ought to, make amends to him publicly because I humiliated him publicly. And my sponsor told me amends was much more than saying I'm sorry. It's about righting the wrong, you know. And I told the group what I did, and then I apologized to Bob, and I said, you know what, God forbid, I said, oh, Bob, I hope I never act that way again. As long as I don't drink, you know, one day at a time and do this, I'm really sorry. You know what, he came up and he hugged me. And we started talking. And now I started talking, so Bob, like, what brings you here? I'm thinking that he's new, you know. And I find out that he's sober 3 years. Now, we have moved. I'm living in South Philadelphia. He lives in Roxborough, which is like the northwest section of the city. And this meeting is in North Philadelphia. He said, Bobby, I've been sober 3 years. And in my arrogance, right, because I figured I know everyone in AA, I'm surprised that our paths haven't crossed. He said, you know what? He said, I was looking for a different meeting tonight, and I was slipping through the meeting list, and for some reason, this meeting jumped out at me. I believe God put that guy in my path that night. Now, I need to tell you, we have 1,600 meetings a week. We have a pretty thick meeting directory, 1,600 meetings a week. And for some reason, this guy, that meeting jumped out at him. I believe that my higher power put that guy in my path that night. And I had two options. I can make amends, or I could do what I did when I used to drink. I pretend I could look you dead in the eye and pretend I didn't know you. I'm sorry, you got me confused. That's my brother. Or another story. But I chose to make amends. And you know what? When he embraced me, man, it was an incredible feeling. Now, the flip side of that. For a while, my home group was the Stepping Stones group. I was at a business meeting one day. I made a motion. It was definitely for the betterment of AA. I know it was. The guy that I was with, one of my friends, didn't agree with me. And, you know, minority opinion, he voiced it. And my motion got shot down. Now, I couldn't believe he did this because I grew up in a neighborhood, right, wrong, or indifferent. You backed your boys regardless. It didn't matter. I couldn't believe he did this to me. I took it as a personal affront. I would come to the group, and you know, there'd be four men there. I would say hi to three of them and would completely ignore Freddie. Wouldn't say nothing at all. One day I'm at work, and my coworker came up to me and said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels is outside. He wants to take care of some sort of business. And I peeked out the window. I saw him. I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall to do that. He can't do that here. And about a few weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, I just want to call you. He said, Freddie died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. Now, here he was, a friend of mine, and as God is my judge, I forget what my motion was about. This guy was a friend of mine. He took a different opinion from me, and I never spoke to him again. And I had opportunity after opportunity, and I'll be forever, you know, I've been praying for Freddie ever since. But especially when that coworker says, Bobby, he always spoke so highly of you. I felt about yay big, and I've been praying for Freddie every day, you know. So that's two examples in a nice step where I was put in position, I made amends, and I'm the one who reaped the rewards. And I had an opportunity to make amends. I chose not to, and I paid the price. So if you're in a similar situation, man, embrace it, because you never know when you're in that situation again. You know, a lot of promises in the program. You know, I get uncomfortable when people say, hey, he doesn't promise you anything. AA promises lots of things, but a lot of these promises happen at the end of the ninth step, you know. No material things, but the intangibles you can't put a price on, you know. The peace of mind, the real friendship, the respect, things like that. Until we know how to handle situations used to baffle us, you know. I started embracing these, you know, because it's a program of action. It has nothing to do with time, you know what. It's just like the real world. You don't become employee of the month or get those yearly bonuses unless you do the work. You go to school, you don't make the dean's list unless you do the work above and beyond. You play sports, you don't get selected for the All-Star team unless you produce above and beyond. Well, the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't get the rewards unless you do the work. It's much more than just showing up. I know, because I just showed up for almost 2 years and I want to end my life. You know what? I was so crazy in my early recovery. I swear, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. Sober almost 2 years. I was going to meetings. I was wondering why everybody was blowing this guy's anonymity. I'm saying, you know what? I wouldn't want to tangle with this dude. He's pretty rough. When I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. But here I was. I was so damn bright. It damn near killed me. In my home group, we got a little pegboard, first name, last, you know, first initial, last name, and then how many years, you know, celebrate anniversaries by the month. If you had more time, like, you know, I'm Bobby C. 1 year, and then you're Joey A. You got 2 years. And if you went out, I used to take pleasure in that. I swear, I was caught up in the seniority deal. I said, oh, he went out. I got more time than him. I was crazy as a bed bug. No one wanted me. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had, you know. I carried the disease. I didn't carry the message. I was nuts. I'm getting involved in these steps, and you know what? I'm getting better. Things around me didn't always get better, but I got better, you know. And probably one of the greatest rewards I got was the urge to end my life was removed, you know. I was, towards the end of my drinking, I couldn't even shave anymore. I get a couple strokes of the razor, and I pictured this in the mirror, that an evil spirit was going to make me take my razor and cut my throat. I actually visualized this. They call them hallucinations now, I guess, but I actually thought this was happening. And I no longer felt that way. You know, I felt like living. There was a purpose in life, you know. And I got excited by this. I really did. I really got excited about this. The 10th step for me is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm standing up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, it wouldn't be the truth. I do it a lot of times. I'm pretty consistent. But I'm the type of guy that says, you know what, you know, try to stay sober on yesterday's sobriety, you know. And I could never stay drunk on yesterday's load. You know, sooner or later, I would need to drink more to get loaded. And, you know, and when it's amazing. All these years, I keep on trying to do it, and it kicks me in the backside every time, you know. And I used to be the guy that said, well, you know what, I'm not affected. No one is affected but me. But you know, I realize everybody I come in contact with is affected, you know. My family, when I act like a nitwit, when I'm pulled off the square, my family feels it because I'm very sarcastic. Sarcasm, they call it the language of the Irish, you know. It's nothing but anger dressed up, that's all it is. I mean, my tongue is terrible, you know. And when I'm flipped with people, things like that's when I'm not working the program. My coworkers, the people I come in contact with on a daily basis, everyone knows. When I'm a nitwit, every other people I come in contact with is affected. And so it's the flip side of that. When I'm on the beam, you know, people around me, they reap the rewards. But most of all, I like this. Like, you know the old saying, you can't miss what you never had? In early recovery, those serene guys, them old-timers, they scared the hell out of me. So what I would do when the meeting was going nice and smooth and real spirit, I would have to get it up and get it goofy because I was comfortable with that. But now, you know what? When people are getting, when I'm in a meeting, when it's crazy or something, I feel like the need to bring it back because I don't like that insanity anymore. You know, I like being on the beam. And the nice thing about doing the legwork, when I get knocked off the beam, I know what I need to do to get back on it, you know. The 11th step sought through prayer and meditation, and I've improved my conscious contact. And the best part of it was that first word sought. You know, I may not practice the religion I was raised in, but you know what? I no longer bash the church because the church wasn't the problem. The Air Force wasn't the problem. The police department wasn't the problem. My neighborhood wasn't the problem. My mother wasn't the problem. The problem was Bobby Coyle, you know, and that's what I found out through the steps. I was the problem. And there was a lot of things about my past that, you know, I'm not proud of and I can't change. But you know what? Another thing that came out of the steps, it's enabled me to change my attitude about the past. You know, I can now, you know, I talk about the incident with my mom. It's still a little painful, but you know what? Years ago, I couldn't even talk about that. I was sober almost 7 years, and I sat down and I told my father what happened and made amends. You know, my father hugged me. He forgave me. I mean, man, I know this program works, you know. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message. That's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been to thousands of meetings since I've been sober, and sometimes I got to look up at the slogans and make sure I'm in an AA meeting. I hear some crazy things. That's the message. You know, we tried to carry this message, and sometimes I have difficulty with the word try. You know, I get done. You know, when I get, you know, point something out to you in the book, when I get done, I want to backhand you with the book. You know, it doesn't work that way. We try to carry the message, and the most important thing, the last part of that, is to practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in an AA meeting an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours, like I talked earlier? Like the thing in my neighborhood. Like my neighborhood, we have a strange phenomenon in my neighborhood. Things have, you know, propensity like to fall off the back of trucks. It's just one of the neighborhoods, you know, things like that. No one has real cable. Everyone has a chip. You know, it's just one of the neighborhoods. Everyone's always scamming and, you know. And in early recovery, I did certain things. And you know what? I can't do that today. Because if I can justify doing that, I can justify doing this. And you know what? I could probably justify having a beer because it's probably been a while. I'll leave that other stuff alone. Just smoke a little reefer. I'll be okay. And I'll be off to the races again. I practice these principles in all my affairs. I don't need to run around and tell people I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. But a lot of people know. Because when they came up to me, you know, they seen to change my behaviors, I tell them. Now, there's a story. A guy across the street from me, his name was Joe. Joe had a bar down the street called Olaps. The bar was a toilet. In fact, when you came in and said, "Where's the toilet?" I would say, "You're standing in it." Towards the end of my drinking, Joe, who watched me grow up as a kid, towards the end of my drinking, would not allow me in his bar. He flagged me. He said, "Bobby, that's it. You can't come in no more." He said, "I've known your family for years. I know what you do for a living. I don't care. You come to my car, come to my bar, I'm going to," and he used some colorful language. I said, "All right, Joe, I'll just go elsewhere." A few years ago, my dad called me up, you know, and he said, "Joe called. I was asking for you. Give him a call." So I called Joe up. He said, "Bobby, do you still go to them AA meetings?" I said, "Yeah, Joe, I do." Joe had a nephew. He had a couple nephews and nieces. When they were little, their parents were killed in an automobile accident, and Joe and his wife raised his nephews and nieces like their own kids. Joe says, "You know what? My nephew just got out of treatment, 17 years old. He said, I was wondering if you could take him to an AA meeting." Now, here was a guy that 10 years ago was threatening me with bodily harm if I went near his toilet of a bar. And now he's trusting me to take his nephew to an AA meeting. That's a reward of the program. And I didn't have to run around and carry the banner to Joe. You know, he knew by the way I was living, you know. And in my neighborhood, bad news travels quickly. So he would have known. He knew that I was still sober. But I guess he just wanted some sort of confirmation. And, you know, his nephew, last summer, he was up at Pensacola with me. 6 years of sobriety. You know, it's incredible. And I knew it was nothing I did. It was the higher power working, you know. Because if I want to claim, like, credit for the successes, I better accept responsibility for the failures. And unfortunately, in my case, my successes are far outnumbered by the failures, you know. But we tried to carry this message. I'm responsible for the effort, not the outcome. And whether he stays sober or not, when I'm out of my head, you know, when I'm working with somebody else, I'm out of my head, you know. I then got involved in service. I learned about the 12 traditions, and that was really incredible. I mean, here was a, you know, in early recovery, I didn't want nothing to do with the steps, let alone traditions. In my line of work, we're really good enforcing the law, but we don't like to follow it ourselves. Cops are the worst. You find anyone in position of authority, they're like that. Directors of programs, you know, bosses, you know, military, cops. I mean, we're real good in giving orders, but we don't like to follow them ourselves. And I wasn't big on the traditions because I saw them as rules. And I later found out that the traditions are to the groups what the steps are to the individuals, you know. And the traditions are cool. The traditions allow us to be wrong. But if you're being wrong just for the sake of being wrong, then that's arrogance and we get to pay for our arrogance. But I really got involved in service, you know, and because of that, I started going to other places. And that was really cool. I got heavily involved in my area and, you know, and ego. I wanted to be one of the youngest delegates from my area, Area 59, to the General Service Conference. And I was on my way. And as an area officer at large, and in 1994, I wound up getting diagnosed with cancer. And that was a real fluke way I found out. And but I went to get a second opinion, and it got confirmed. And I remember as I was driving home, the very first thought that entered my mind, "Bobby, you can smoke reefer because people in chemotherapy smoke pot." It was amazing. It was the very first thought. And I didn't smoke any pot, you know, and because I'd been to thousands of meetings, I saw some men and women go through some terrible things of their own, and they got through it without picking up a drink, you know. Life on life's terms, you know what? And my sponsor, who would get sick and pass away shortly, he helped me tremendously, you know. He said, Bobby, so what are you going to do about this? So, you know, I started going in treatment, and I had to give up my service position, and that was tough for me. And again, it goes out of ego. Again, I wanted to be the youngest delegate, and but the area was suffering. I just couldn't do my job. So I left work sick, and after getting out of hospital, I was laid up in my home for a bit. And people started coming to my house. I mean, you're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took my entire life. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people started coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm talking even people, not even really good friends, people I just met like at a workshop or something like that. They would come to my house, carry the message. You know, and I think my doctors did a pretty good job, but I'm a firm believer in the prayer and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went into remission, and I don't want you to think I handled this well, because I didn't. You know what? Lung cancer. I never smoked in my life. And then again, the arrogance. You know what? On the pity pots. You know, like, what the hell? You know, why? Like, I'm sober for a while. I'm doing the right thing. And I, even though I may have, you know, an excuse to go out and get loaded, I didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. I had a pretty good life, and I got things squared away. The one thing in my experience, getting news like this, it really helped me finish up that ninth step, you know. Again, because even though I may not have practiced the way I raised, you know, them thoughts were still in the back, you know, you're still going to reap the rewards, and I still thought the scales were like this, so I finished up that ninth step. I went in remission. I wound up getting sick again. They finally removed the lower left lobe of my lung. And again, it was the prayers of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that without a doubt. You know, and life on life terms. I was in Mexico about 10 years ago, and I thought I could speak Spanish because I used to work the barrio of Philadelphia. My Spanish, I consisted of like Dame Pistola, you know, things like that. And But I was in this meeting. I was the only English-speaking person in the room. And I thought I could speak Spanish. I'm speaking for a couple minutes. I could tell by their looks that I'm just like butchering it. And I got tired of insulting them. So I switched over to English. And they still didn't know what the hell I was saying. But you know what? At the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. Language of the heart. And you know what? I could tell who the old timer was by the serenity in their face. And I can tell who the newcomer was by the pain in their face. You know? And it's incredible. You know? I don't want you to think I'm the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm not. I say, come live with me for a week, you know. And a couple people take me up on that, and they found out quickly. You know, I still got character defects, you know what. But I know I'm not intentionally harming people. I know I'm not the guy that I was when I came in. And you know what, for the most part, I'm aware of these defects. I try to do the right thing, you know. I try to lead a decent life and try to help new guys, and that's about it. And you know what, I love the way I live. I'm a lifelong mummer, and I'm going to wrap this up, and this is the end. Most of you people don't know what a mummer is. It's a New Year's parade we do in Philadelphia. It's a couple hundred years old. We just officially just had our 100th parade this past year. It's New Year's Day. It's something like the Mardi Gras. Like, the Mardi Gras stole their idea from us, you know. But what it is, it's like about 30,000 men in sequins and feathers and makeup, and we get in the middle of the street, and we play instruments, and we party. Now I've done my fifth step, so I can tell you about this stuff, no big deal. But it's a blast. It's almost like a combination. It's like the Mardi Gras and the Full Monty. It is. That's like the, that's the mummer. And mummers, it's taken from King Mummus, who is the Greek god of ridicule. That's where mummers is coming from. So we're cultural also. It's a drunk fest. It is nothing. The booze flows, and that's all it is. It's an excuse to get loaded. I'm at a meeting, and this was 11 years ago, I'm in a meeting, I tell my story, I said, I'm a lifelong mummer. He came up to me afterwards, he said, listen, would you be interested in watching the parade this year? I said, no way, people, places, and things. Can't go. He said, no, you don't understand. He said, we got a group, we got a brigade together called the 12 Steppers. Everyone's in the program. I said, cool. Sober mummers. It's an oxymoron. So I marched that year. I went up in that parade, and this past year, the last 10 years, I've gone up with the 12 Steppers, sober mummers. And 2 years ago, our brigade came in first place. It's amazing. This past year, I marched in my 36th parade. Now, when I first got sober, I had to take a few years off. But here I was. I'm able to do something that's like I'm a third-generation mummer, a big part of my family. Unfortunately, I'm the only sober member of my family. But I had to stay away from that for a while. But here it is, something that I really enjoyed doing. It was part of me. and I get to do it sober. And I say that because one of my favorite passages in the Big Book says we absolutely insist on enjoying life. If the newcomer could see no joy in our existence, they won't want nothing to do with us. Obviously, I paraphrased that last line, but Bill was a little bit more eloquent. But, you know, you get the picture. I say that because there may be some new people here. And if you're new and you think, oh, your life is over, you got to wear the hair shirt and, you know, beat yourself up, and it's nuts. You don't need to do that. Recovery is great. But it's also a program of action. Those rewards come after we take some action. Like, you can't dance your way to recovery. But you know what? If you're sober, whatever you did drunk, you could do stone cold sober. You'd be better at it, but most of all, you can remember it. It's a blast, you know? Whatever it is, you know? I left my job, and I went back to school. In my 30s, I went back to school. I pledged a fraternity at the age of 37. You know what? And I called a few up, and I told them, I said, listen, you know, police officer, I don't drink. I'm 37, and I'd like to pledge a fraternity. Most of them hung up on me. But I was in my last semester of school, and I really wanted to get the full college experience. You know, I went back. So I called this place up, right? And the guy answered the phone. He said, you know what? That's how I say it. He said, I don't drink either. I said, really? He said, no, we'd love to have you. Come on over. I really thought they didn't believe me, and they went to eye me up. And this fraternity, you know, they had some principles that were similar to AA. You know, and I know Bill didn't write this down like in 1935. I mean, we begged, borrowed, and stole from a lot of different places. But, virtue, diligence, and brotherly love. And they were similar to our principles. And they were involved in community involvement. And in fact, they had not that they had an alcohol stand, but their particular chapter was a dry house, you know. And that was pretty cool, you know. And then I went to grad school, and then I became I was their academic advisor, you know, I developed a program for the undergrads. And you know what? That was cool. And the great thing I liked about this, at no time did I tell these guys, listen, when I was your age, you know, I told someone about my background, I would be able to help them. But you know what? These were just young men, decent young men, guys that I never hung around with. I always hung around with the nitwits. Decent young men scared the hell out of me. You know, these are good kids, and you know what? It was great. And rewarded recovery. I was allowed to get involved in certain things, you know. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. I encourage my sponsor real quick. My sponsor, Troubles, passed away. He was a young man. He was 51 when he died. And I didn't have a sponsor for a while, and, you know, I had no home group. I had one in name only, but I floundered there for a bit, sober for a while. And you know what? I paid the price because I was sponsoring men, and I felt like a hypocrite because I was telling these guys to do things that, you know, myself I wasn't doing. And I caught myself getting off the beam, you know, got myself a new sponsor, got involved in the starting of a group, which really I didn't want to do. In fact, if it were up to me, we had 1,600 meetings a week. I would probably get rid of half of them, but it's not up to me. But we got a group going, and we're big. We greet everyone who comes in the door. We're big involved in service, you know. The principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's those things that those old guys passed down to us that I'll be forever indebted, you know. I love being sober. But if you're new, please grab yourself a home group. Get yourself a sponsor. You know, enjoy the journey. It's a wonderful way of life. And I thank you, and I know my family definitely thanks you for putting up with me all these years. And I'd like to thank the committee for the privilege of participating in the AA meeting. That's all I got. Thanks.